Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what does the recent Supreme Court case upholding the Indian Child Welfare Act mean for Indian adoption law? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. This month, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its opinion in a case, Holland versus Brackeen. It involves the adoption of Indian children by white families, and it is covered under the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. Court observers, in particular those with experience in Indian law, feared that this Supreme Court would overturn ICWA and remove any tribal interest in Indian adoption cases. But the outcome was a bit of a surprise, and it maintained ICWA, at least in most of its form, at this point. But it has left unresolved many issues in Indian law and is actually just one of several cases in Indian law the court has heard in this term. So on today's show, we will discuss the future of ICWA, what the court decided, what this decision means for the future of Indian law at the Supreme Court, and how it fits with other decisions the court has made. Our panel today is Gregory Oblosky. He is the Marion Rice Kirkwood Professor of Law at Stanford Law School. He's the author of The Savage Constitution, The Indian Child Welfare Act, and The Presentment Clause, A Very Pink Herring, and Federal Ground Governing Property and Violence in First U.S. Territories. He also filed an amicus brief in the case Holland versus Brackeen. Robert Miller is professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He is the interim chief justice at Pascua Yaqui Tribe Court of Appeals. He's the author of Reservation Capitalism, Economic Development in Indian Country and Native America, Discovered and Conquered, Thomas Jefferson, Lewis and Clark, and Manifest Destiny, and most recently, A Promise Kept, The Muskogee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma, and he is an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. And N. Bruce Dutu. He's the Samson Occam Professor and former chair of the Native American and Indigenous Studies at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Shadow Nations, Tribal Sovereignty and the Limits of Legal Pluralism, and American Indians and the Law, and was a contributing author of Felix S. Cohen's Handbook of Federal Law, the leading treatise on that issue, and has co-produced a documentary called Dawland, a film about the impact of the removal of children from Wabanaki families for placement in foster homes with white families. And Professor Dutu is an enrolled tribal member of the United Houma Nation of Louisiana. Thank you all very, very much for joining us. Greg Oblosky, I'm going to ask you the first question. Since you filed the amicus brief and have quite a bit of knowledge about this, the specific case, Holland versus Brackeen, what exactly was this case about and how was it decided?
So the case was about a lot of things. It was a broad challenge to the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA, which you already alluded to. And ICWA is basically a statute that when a Indian child, the term of art, is being placed away from their parents, there are various sort of procedural protections that come into play. And a number of sort of conservative think tanks launched a broad challenge through some of these adoptive parents, the Brackeens, and then were later joined by the state of Texas, challenging ICWA on a bunch of different constitutional grounds. They argued it exceeded Congress's power under Article 1 of the Constitution. They said that it commandeered the states in violation of the 10th Amendment. They said that it was a violation of equal protection because it discriminated on the basis of race. And they said also that it impermissibly delegated authority to the tribe. So really, it was a smorgasbord of constitutional attacks. And the court, by 7-2 vote, rejected those attacks on various grounds. So it rejected the enumerated powers challenge and the anti-commandeering challenges straight up. And then with respect to both the equal protection and the non-delegation challenges, it held that the plaintiffs lacked standing. In other words, they didn't actually have the ability to bring the lawsuit, and so sort of told them to go back and try again. So some of them were rejected on the merits, some of them were rejected on standing grounds, but the upshot was it upheld the law across the board against this challenge.
And also to follow up, you filed an amicus brief. What was the main argument you were making within that brief?
So this was a brief that grew out of research I had done years ago, historical research. And it focused primarily on the first question that I talked about, congressional authority to enact ICWA in the first place. So Justice Thomas, back in 2013, wrote a concurrence in the adoptive couple case, which was another ICWA case, in which he said, oh, by the way, if you look at the history, maybe Congress lacked the authority to actually enact ICWA. And I'd been doing some archival work on this question, and I thought that actually he was wrong, and he relied on some very flawed sources. And so I wrote an article in 2015 sort of critiquing some of the arguments. And so as this issue percolated up, this was my attempt to sort of get some of my archival work and findings before the court, because I predicted accurately, as it turns out, that this was going to be a fight over sort of how to properly understand the original constitutional history and meaning. And so I was hoping that my work would make some difference around that question.
We're going to return to that, because when you have a court that has such an emphasis on original intent, you know, the historical intent and et cetera, it's absolutely essential that we hear from the historians, because frankly, the court gets the history wrong, you know, frequently. Now, Bruce Dutu, you have worked on issues explicitly about the adoption of Indian children by white families and historically what that impact has been. Talk to us about that question and why this is such an essential issue in Indian law and Indian sovereignty.
Yes, thanks very much. So this gets at the, you know, what was the problem for which ICWA was seen as a possible solution? So what were the facts? What was going on in states across the country? And the problem was the inordinate removal of Native children by state social workers and being placed overwhelmingly in non-Native homes. As Justice Gorsuch's concurring opinion makes very, very clear, this was simply the latest iteration of a long series of federal policies aimed at really the erasure of Indigenous peoples, or at least culture, from across the landscape, starting with separation from traditional homelands, boarding schools where there was records of abuse and various forms. Even the urbanization projects of the 50s were seen as ways to sever the cord of cultural ties of Native children to their communities. And then there was a project called the Federal Adoption Project, which accelerated or put some resources into encouraging the outplacement of Native children into non-Indian homes. So all of this kind of led to Congress holding hearings in the 70s that put a spotlight on this issue and led to the passage of ICWA, building on the tribe's sovereignty to basically play a seminal, hopefully, role in decisions when a Native child did need to be in another home for issues because of neglect or abuse, that the tribe would have a say in making those calls. So my involvement in looking at what was happening in our neighbors in Maine was a nonprofit tribal organization had been working, putting some attention on the high rates of outplacement of Native children in the state of Maine, and looking for some process to do something about it. And they thought about litigation, they thought about, you know, press conferences, but they were drawn to the format of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They'd paid attention to what had happened in Canada. They'd looked at other places like Rwanda, South Africa, and thought that what they really wanted to do was to provide a mechanism where families and individuals could tell their stories outside of the limited confines, or I should say the restrictive confines of litigation, where only certain stories get to be told. And so by some miracle, the state of New Hampshire, a governor agreed to this. There was a formal signing ceremony to create what was in effect the first Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the U.S. on the issue of child welfare removal. Coincidentally, I work with a team of filmmakers who were given permission to record the proceedings of the commission in real time. And then it took a couple of years after to do all the post-production and so forth. And that's what made up the film Dawnland, which I'm very pleased to say won an Emmy Award for research. What the film describes is typical of what has happened in other states. The problem of the state officials making what they felt was decisions in the best interest of the child to remove them because of gross misunderstandings of a family organization in Native communities. There could be extended kin systems where the child may have a support network beyond just a nuclear family. There's rampant poverty. There are other forms of socioeconomic ills that basically fed a bias or a prejudice against Native peoples to say they're not fit parents. And so this led to the outplacement of inordinate numbers of Native children. So we have to remember that ICWA was passed in 1978, and here we are 45 years later, and in many states, Native children are still at high risk for being removed. They are overly represented in the ranks of children in the foster care system of states around the country.
And Robert Miller, I want to bring you in. You've written this wonderful book on McGirt versus Oklahoma. And so in the broader context, is this a signal, the fact that ICWA was not overturned, that the tribes, which haven't had a really great record in recent years at the Supreme Court, that the record might be improving, or is it kind of a unique development?
No, I'm very encouraged by this. I will tell you that I seriously gulped when I heard that the Supreme Court took cert in this case. I don't know what Bruce and Greg think, but I literally feared for a while that Indian law as a separate discipline would be going away. Because if the Supreme Court were to reach this decision that Indian law is just a race-based affirmative action field of law, then the thousands of laws that Congress has enacted since 1789 for Indian peoples, Indian nations, and Indian affairs would probably be held as a violation. Now, it didn't take me too long to think, gosh, that cannot happen. Originalist, textualist justices, who at least six of these claim they are, and Justice Kagan said, we are all originalists now. The research that Greg did, what did the founding fathers think of tribal nations? They signed treaties for 500 years, Spain, England, Holland, Russia, and then the colonies and then the United States had dealt with tribes as governments. Our own Constitution in the original version, 1787, and then in the 14th Amendment said that Indian peoples were not citizens of a state or of the United States. Obviously, the original framers of those provisions knew that Indians were citizens of their own governments. So that fear went away. But I was still saying that the best we could hope for was that the Supremes would only affirm the Fifth Circuit and we would lose two or three provisions of the Indian Child Welfare Act to what is called the anti-commandeering argument. This is a 10th Amendment argument that certain powers are reserved to the states and the federal government cannot enact them and cannot infringe on state powers. But yes, as already has been said, this case was a fabulous win and the ICWA was upheld in every provision.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. Today's topic, we're talking about Indian law, the future of ICWA, and the case Holland versus Brackeen with Greg Obloski of Stanford University, Bruce Dutu of Dartmouth College, and Robert Miller of Arizona State University. Greg, actually, Bob just mentioned something that I've been wrestling with myself, that ultimately Indian law is predicated on the notion that Indian identity or Indian rights is not race-based. If it's not race-based, what exactly is it then?
So there's two ways to answer that question. One is to point to the doctrine, and the doctrine says, since 1973, when the court decided Morton versus Mancari, that Indian classifications are political classifications rather than racial ones. And the reason the court reached that conclusion was, they said, look, it rests on tribal membership rather than sort of as being participant or a member of the race of Indians, and so therefore it is a political classification. I think the second answer to that question steps outside the world of doctrine and thinks a little bit about the complexities of Native identity and status. That, you know, when you look at the history, there are definitely instances in which Native peoples are racialized, are defined racially by Anglo-Americans. But when I dug into the history, what I found was, in fact, there is also this longstanding, important, significant history of considering Native peoples as citizens of these quasi-sovereign, separate sovereigns within the borders of the United States, Native nations. And, you know, Morton versus McCurry, even though it's not an originalist decision, didn't dig very deeply into the past, I think nonetheless rests on that long history and legacy by which actually Native peoples were recognized and thought of as belonging to this separate polity. And so I think that the decision actually has a lot of legitimacy in terms of a description of some strains of American practice. So it's not to sort of ignore or downplay the way that Native peoples were racialized. Anyone who spent any time in the history of the United States, this is obvious. But I think as a legal conclusion, there's a lot of a lot to defend Morton.
To follow up then, when you talk about the question about tribal membership, I mean, when I hear that, I think, I guess one key difference about it being political and a member of a tribe versus it being a race is the tribe's ability to determine who's a member of the tribe. One of the things about sovereignty is, I mean, a sovereign entity gets to choose who gets to be citizens through their laws. Am I reading that correctly then? I mean, at some point it is about the sovereign tribal empowerment to determine who's actually a part of a tribe, which makes it more like a sovereign entity than a race, where that question is not necessarily present in a political entity that will determine what race you are.
So I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, this is something that the defenders of ICWA urged from the beginning, that, look, the ability to define membership is part and parcel of a tribe's sovereignty. And it makes it no different from when the United States determines citizenship or foreign nations determine citizenship. What the people on the other side argued was that, you know, when you look to how tribes define membership, they say, look, many tribes rely on ideas about descent or maybe even requirements above blood quantum. And that transforms this, at least to the extent it's incorporated into federal law, into, in fact, a racial classification. There are lots of reasons why I think that is implausible, in part because it then violates the space of the separate sovereign and what the sovereign is doing, right? We don't look to determine whether someone is a Spanish citizen to see, like, okay, well, is Spain making its determinations based on ancestry and therefore they're impermissible? So I don't think it's a legally compelling argument, but that is the argument on the other side, that actually the definitions of citizenship that these separate sovereigns are making are themselves in some ways derived from ancestry.
This is Bob Miller, but the Supreme Court and other federal courts have said over and over and over that the decision of who is a citizen of tribe X, Y, or Z is not up to the federal government, not up to the state governments, and is only up to the tribes. So it reinforces what you just stated.
I mean, my own background in international relations, I think about how this plays out as, you know, what is a sovereign power? And so it's the tribes who determine who are members of the tribe. I mean, that's rooted in the concept of sovereignty, which then makes this, it's not exactly an international issue because you're talking about sovereign entities existing within the U.S., but closer to an international issue even than a domestic issue. Am I overstating that?
I think that's right. I mean, certainly when you look at the history, I mean, this was one of the things I tried to spend a lot of time on in the brief, is trying to say, look, like the analogy between Native nations and foreign nations was not sort of simply an analogy that was floating around. It was, in fact, one of the ways that they grappled with the question of Native status within the borders of the United States. Now, you know, we ultimately get Cherokee Nation, which says that Native nations are not fully foreign separate nations. But nonetheless, it's a real analogy in thinking about Native status. And so I think incorporating more of the recognition of those historical ties between what was described as foreign affairs and Indian affairs is really helpful for thinking through some of the current jurisprudential challenges that we're facing.
And Bruce, you have some thoughts on this.
Yeah. So one of the things I often share with my students is, and this relates to these broader issues that we've been talking about, is our schools just don't teach about tribes as sovereign nations. So this is a really poorly understood part of American history and certainly American law and policy. And that makes the understanding the nuances of federal Indian law deeply troubling for even judges who encounter some of these cases for the very first time. They've never studied it, many of them in law school. Many of them are hearing it for the very first time. They utterly lack historical context for understanding the distinctive role of tribes as political bodies. Most Americans don't know that tribes are actually mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. One of the provisions that was at issue in here is that Congress has power to regulate commerce with the foreign nations, with the among the states, and with the Indian tribes. There was a study just a few years ago looking at American curriculum in terms of what is taught or not taught. What is the substantive content that our students are learning about Native peoples? And one of the findings that struck me was that about 87% of school curricula that had any reference to Native peoples stopped at 1900. In other words, it was very much a sort of old history that was being taught. You know, the settlers came over, they met a few Indians, and then that's either in the preface or chapter one of most history books, and then they disappear. They're no longer in the picture. And so to note that only about 13% of school curricula, K through 12, actually carry on the narrative into the modern era and talk about Native peoples in contemporary life, that they are living, breathing cultures and citizens with their own tribal governments and so forth, is a fact that most of my students are encountering for the very first time at a school like Dartmouth College. And so I don't take for granted that the things we talk about and accept as normative are widely known or shared around the country. And I think that makes cases like the Brackeen case and ICWA, but almost any issue in Indian country so troubling, because it's like, well, why can Native people get to do this? Why can they fish out of season, and why can they have casinos? And all of these sorts of questions are sort of issues of first impression for many Americans. And that just doubles the stakes, because if you get it wrong, it may be consistent with some notions of equal protection of the law, that we're one nation, you know, one law. And for others, for the tribes themselves, it's again this notion of being erased, of being eradicated from the landscape.
And Bob Miller, you had some thoughts as well.
Yes, I have two brief thoughts. One thing I've been analogizing to my classes the last few years is the treaty rights that nations have, so Indian nations. And so the Indian citizens share those rights. And I give this analogy. Well, what if we had a treaty with Germany that all German citizens could go to our national parks for free? We wouldn't ask we would just ask if these people have a German passport, and they get to go for free. And that's an international law treaty type right the tribal peoples have. And so it might be different than the average American has. And the second point I want to make that picks up on what Bruce said, a Supreme Court who knows nothing about Indian law, probably matching those statistics Bruce just gave us. And this is one reason Justice Gorsuch's nomination was welcomed by the National Congress of American Indians and many other tribal groups, etc., that here was a judge from the West. He had been 11 years on the 10th United States Court of Appeals, the 10th Circuit it's called, and he had sat on something like 70 cases, I believe, and written about 24 opinions himself on Indian law. So we were delighted that someone, you know, he didn't always rule for tribes, so it wasn't that we were hoping for, but just here would be a Supreme Court justice that had a background in Indian law and Indian history.
No, absolutely. And Greg, this makes me think, this current court, there's different descriptions, but at least one of the descriptions has been this dominance of originalism, the whole concept of original intent. And it seems like from what I'm hearing here, considering the Constitution references tribes, there's definitely a historic recognition of the sovereignty of tribes, that we should expect that if justices are asserting an original intent, especially if they become knowledgeable or aware of Indian law, as Bruce suggests, this is a court that should be more open to tribal sovereignty than previous courts. Is that Pollyannish, or is it exposing that maybe what's referred to as original intent isn't exactly original intent, or what's the expectation?
A couple things. I mean, certainly the vision that you presented is the one that Justice Gorsuch takes up in his concurrence, right? I mean, he very much presents a originalist vision in defense of tribal sovereignty. But there is the contrary originalist view presented by Justice Thomas in his dissent in the case, which is sort of a wholesale critique of the idea that the federal government has authority in this area. Oh, and by the way, maybe also tribes are not really even sovereign in the same way anymore on originalist grounds. So, you know, I think the original premise, so to speak, of originalism was that history was going to provide a sort of neutral, unbiased, objective way to resolve these heated legal questions. And the problem is, of course, that history is not a clear, obvious, or objective way to resolve questions. It turns out that people disagree just as much on how to interpret history as they do about how to interpret law. And of course, when the stakes are high, as they are in any case which goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, then people are going to fight deeply about how to interpret the history just as much as they're going to fight about how to interpret the law. So the vision you laid out is certainly the one that I have advanced through my historical research. But, you know, I think it's important to stress, like, there were people who disagreed very strenuously with me about this in the lead up to this case. And so, you know, I think this is the challenge, is that people disagree. They fight. They're going to fight in law. They're going to fight about policy, and they're going to fight about history, particularly when it's tied to really important outcomes that they care about.
I can reinforce that as somebody with a bit of a history training and use history of my international relations. The idea there's some sort of objective history of everybody agrees to is such a Pollyannish view of what history actually is and what history should be. But Bruce, you have some thoughts as well.
Yeah. So picking up on what Greg was just saying, you know, in my book, Shadow Nations, I talk about sort of parallel narratives. On the one hand, there is the sort of documentary record that led to the formation of the Constitution. You know, there's no sunset provision, at least textually, on the existence of tribes. This is a power that is seen as Congress will regulate commerce, a term of art, intercourse with tribal nations. But there's also a parallel discourse that's sort of more of on a social or cultural level, where there was this sort of widespread belief, I guess, of the imminent demise of Native peoples, that they were not long for the world. And so what many of us call this is the dying Indian thesis, is that, you know, well, they're declining in population, a lot of it through disease, some of it through warfare, et cetera, assimilation, mixed marriages, the whole sorts of sort of normal evolution of cultures. And, you know, some of the early justices of the Supreme Court, Joseph Story, for example, gave a lecture, I'm sure more than one lecture, very poetically, almost like a eulogy for a passing, dying race. And he sent his speech to John Marshall. They served contemporaneously back in the early 19th century. And Marshall says, you know, thank you, Joe, good story. And I share the sentiments completely. Now, which sentiments he shared completely, don't exactly know. But the broader proposition was, these are not peoples that we will long have to contend with. And it's always been a thought in my mind to say, every generation seems to have had that attitude, that notion that these arrangements, whatever we come up with in terms of you're solving the Indian problem of the day, whether it's reservations or allotment, urbanization, et cetera, was seen as like the fix. We're finally going to fix this Indian problem because they're all dying anyway. And it reached a certain, that attitude, that dying Indian thesis reached a nadir in 1913, when Congress set aside lands at the tip of Staten Island, where there was plans to build a statue that had it been, that would be a memorial or monument to the departed race, as I was referred to historically. And had it been built, this thing would have been about 15 feet taller than the Statue of Liberty. Now, there's a part of me, the cynical side of me, that wishes the damn thing would have been built so that we'd have to forever explain this attitude that we were, as a nation, constantly preparing for the death of this entire people, so we'd be rid of their cultures that were seen as pagan, as uncivilized, as savage, And more importantly, we'd be rid of the challenges to power, political power. No treaties, no Indians. There's no treaties. We don't have to worry about reservation lands, and Manifest Destiny can run unbridled. They were always, you know, as Thomas King says, the inconvenient Indians. They're always in the way.
And Bob Miller, you have some thoughts as well.
Well, I cannot resist following up with what Bruce said with quoting my favorite quote now, or should I call it my unfavorite quote. But General George Washington wrote a letter to Congress on September 7, 1783, and I wish every American knew about this. He compared Indians to wolves, to animals. It's called The Savage as the Wolf Letter. And on the fourth page, after he made that analogy, Indians, the savage is the wolf, here's what he said, then says, and this is a quote, both being beasts of prey, though they differ in shape. So what did the Constitution mean? What did our founding fathers think? Were they hunting the native peoples, their lands, their assets? What did George Washington mean when he said that Indians are beasts of prey? That is pretty chilling. And a pretty chilling idea. So I think America may be shocked, and George Washington, if he could come back today, might be shocked to see tribes still exercising their treaty rights, still owning the amount of lands and assets they do, and exercising the political power and sovereignty that they do.
Let's get that letter and post it to the show webpage so that it is easily accessed by any of our listeners.
You'll find it on the National Archives.
When we come back, is adoption of Indian children based on child welfare or tribal interests? We'll explore why this is a false distinction when we return. Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Why is the Indian Child Welfare Act, or the ICWA, essential in preserving the tribes, their identity, and their sovereignty? How does the recent Supreme Court case, Holland versus Brackeen, affect these issues? What does it resolve, and what does it leave unresolved? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Gregory Oblofsky, who is the Marion Rice Kirkwood Professor of Law at Stanford Law, Robert Miller, who is Professor of Law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University, and also an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe, and Bruce Dutu, the Samson Occam Professor and former Chair of Native American and Indigenous Studies at Dartmouth College, and is an enrolled tribal member of the United Hoomi Nation of Louisiana. So, ICWA, at one point, and Greg, I'll ask this of you, at one point in his dissent, I believe Justice Thomas argued that ICWA was no longer valid and tribal law perhaps no longer valid because, and I'll paraphrase, and maybe you can directly quote, so many tribal members don't actually live on tribal land. In many ways, what he was saying, it struck me, is what exactly is tribal identity anyway? Why do we need to have tribal law? First of all, is that an accurate reading of what that dissent suggested? And then second, what is the relationship between ICWA and that observation?
This stems from one of the main attacks that Texas and the challengers leveled against ICWA. So there's lots and lots of federal regulation and governance tracing back again to the founding that deals with this legal space known as Indian country, right? That is defined by these lands that Native peoples own and govern. And ICWA is a little different from some of those in the sense that it encompasses both Indian country, but it also encompasses adoptions that happen outside of Indian country that involve Indian children who are not living within the boundaries of reservations or other Native lands. And so the argument that Texas advanced was that, well, this goes beyond the scope of congressional authority, that maybe Congress's authority extends within the boundaries of Indian country, but it does not encompass these adoptions that happened well outside of it. So I think there's two things to say about this. Once again, a sort of legal argument, and then the other, a sort of broader point. The legal argument is just that this view was rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court a very long time ago in the middle of the 19th century in a case called United States versus Holiday, in which they said, actually, the federal power to regulate relations with Native peoples is actually not limited solely to Indian lands. So, you know, there is that tension with well-established court precedent. But I think more broadly, the challenge is simply the refusal to acknowledge that Native peoples sort of change and develop and move in the same way that other residents of the United States do. And in fact, often this was a direct product of federal policy, that actually the federal government in the mid-20th century, in the 50s and 60s, was engaged in the wholesale relocation of Native peoples from Indian country to cities. And that Native people would, you know, constantly move back and forth from cities to Native lands. And so this was just a ubiquitous feature of Native life. And so I think it's an attempt by Justice Thomas to try to grasp for some limiting principles of this authority to reach the results that he wanted to reach, even when, you know, neither law nor common sense really support it.
And Bruce, please, you have a response.
Well, we talked in the first segment about textualism and originalism, and one of the leading proponents of that philosophy or that practice, if you will, was the late Antonin Scalia. And Scalia was a participant in one of the first ICWA case to get to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he voted with the majority in that case to uphold a decision that said there was the need to define the jurisdictional reach of who has authority in a particular case when a child is domiciled or resides in Indian country. In that particular case, the biological parents had taken great steps to not have their children born on the reservation. They left the reservation. This is down in Mississippi, had the babies down in Gulfport, and then returned to the reservation. And so the argument was that the tribe did not have jurisdiction because these kids were never present on the reservation. And the court disagreed and said, well, they're minors and domicile is a sort of a state of mind. What is that place you call home? And minors don't get to decide that until they're adults. And so common law taught that they would take the domicile of the parents. And in the case of unmarried couples, as this couple was, the domicile of the mother, which was the Mississippi Choctaw Reservation. And so in following ICWA, only the tribal court could make that decision, which meant that the 3.5-year-old, by now 3.5-year-old kids had to be, the process had to start all over again. Scalia was a part of a panel or a debate with Stephen Breyer, a program moderated by Jan Crawford many years later, when she asked the two justices a question about could they recall a case where they were torn between the demands of justice, their sort of own appreciation of notions of justice, and the demands of the law. And I don't recall what Breyer said, kind of rambling on different things, but Scalia used the Holyfield case as his exemplar. He says, well, we had this case, and he mostly got the facts right. Pretty remarkable for the number of cases that justices hear over the years. And he said, we decided the majority, yeah, this had to go back to the tribal court to start over if we're being faithful to what the people's representatives decided. And then he offered his own view. He said, now, if it were up to me, if I were applying my own sense of justice, that's not what I would have held. I would have thought we would have honored and vindicated the interests and the wishes of the biological parents. If they did not want their children to be in an Indian home on the reservation, they may have had very good reasons. Native communities are very intimate, small places, unlike adopting a child in a broader state in Los Angeles or Minneapolis. Parents giving up their children for adoption can be assured of anonymity. That may not be the case in a small tribal community where that kid is going to be there and someone's going to say, that was your kid and you gave him up for adoption or something like that. We don't know why the biological parents gave up their child. But Scalia, in saying that in very layman's terms, that he says, I think we should have allowed the wishes of the parents to govern. place the kids where they want to go. I use that as an entree into talking about, you know, at the more abstracted level, one of the other tensions that ICWA brings up, which is this tension between individual rights and group rights. And what ICWA does explicitly is it elevates the interests of the tribe on par with the best interests of the child. And for many judges, that is an alien concept and makes ICWA particularly difficult. It doesn't mean that they can't understand it and wrap their heads around it and apply the law. It's just not how they're taught. You know, in our system of governance, the individual is the sort of moral unit of that regime. And so we have this sort of anathema about we've done so badly with assigning, you know, privileges and immunities to groups, usually the groups that are disfavored. You know, women can't vote. African-Americans are seen as property, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we know where this history comes from, but philosophically, it has been another thing that makes ICWA particularly troubling for a lot of jurists.
Yeah, and I'm going to follow up very, very quickly on this one, too, because, I mean, my familiarity and the way I kind of view ICWA from an international or comparative perspective is not that dissimilar to the way the Australians and the so-called stolen generation with Indigenous populations, and Australia has gone so far as to actually acknowledge that the policy of removing Indigenous children from homes was genocidal. They've actually recognized this genocide. But the tension here is that those children removed from their homes, adopted in white families, materially may have benefited, you know, being a part of a wealthier family, different aspects of education, et cetera. But the Australians recognize, even though materially the child might be better off, there were two tensions. One is the right of the tribes, the right of the Indigenous peoples to maintain a culture, to maintain an identity, and also the right of the child to have access to their and knowledge of their own cultural background, their own cultural identity. I would imagine, I haven't read this, that's a motivation for ICWA. I would draw to the conclusion that that has to be one of the reasons why ICWA is so essential. You know, it's kind of similar to that. Greg, you were going to respond.
Yeah, I just think a couple of things. So one, the point that you just made about access to material resources is something that the Burkeans in this litigation and others have made, that they will be able to provide more fully for the children. You know, I mean, I'm not an expert on child welfare, but I do talk to some people who are experts on child welfare. And one of the striking things that you hear from many of the children who were adopted was actually that they suffered tremendously, right? This was not advantageous to them. I mean, sometimes the homes were actually not necessarily better off. Sometimes there were instances of abuse, right? I mean, it's not the case that you know, white families have no problems and Native people have the problems, right? Like, it is definitely the case that they oftentimes were not materially better off. More broadly, I think the framing of this as there's the best interests of the child on the one side and then the interests of the tribe on the other, and these are somehow in tension, is the wrong way to frame it. I was actually just speaking with my colleague, Michael Wald, who was actually one of the people who helped draft ICWA back in 1978, who's one of the leading scholars on child welfare. And one of the things that he pointed out was the best interests of the child standard is not a straightforward, clear-cut standard. Someone has to decide and define what the best interests of the child are. And oftentimes what that means is judges are making very broad determinations. So in other words, this is a provision that sometimes empowers judges. Often, you know, and then judges can sometimes make irresponsible or poorly reasoned or arbitrary decisions. And so what he pointed out is that legislatures have long attempted to be in the business of defining what the best interests of the child are to cabin the sort of arbitrariness of those rulings. In other words, they're trying to give this broad standard some content. And what he argued, and seems plausible to me, is that ICWA is more or less an attempt to give clear-cut content to this amorphous standard. In other words, ICWA was Congress's attempt to try to statutorily work out what the best interests of the child are. Now, maybe you disagree with that. Maybe people disagree with the outcome that Congress has reached. And there is a viable avenue for them to lodge their protest, which is to have Congress enact a different law But, you know, I think the idea that we should then empower judges to step in, because really they are the ones who should be deciding, only the people only deciding these questions, overlooks a really important question of separation of powers.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker, and we're discussing the case Holland versus Brackeen, delving into the meanings of ICWA, separation of powers questions, the impact this has had, both on adoption policy, adoption law, as well as broadly Indian law, with Greg Oblofsky of Stanford University, Bruce Dutu of Dartmouth College, and Robert Miller of Arizona State University. And Bob, you have some thoughts on this as well.
Yes, I have two follow-up points. The idea of the best interests of the child, I only have anecdotal evidence on this, but there's the slang word of being an apple, red on the inside and white on the did I say that right? Yeah, a red person, Indian on the outside, but actually being a white person on the inside. I hate saying it in this way, but this is, you've heard of other references. The anecdotal evidence I'm referring to is that the suicide rates for teen kids that grow up in this way, and so maybe Bruce or Greg know better than me the actual statistics, but I think they're enormous. A child who's played with a particular group of kids all their life all of a sudden finds they're on the outside. So is it automatically in the best interest of a child to be with an Anglo-American family? I would say not. But one point I want to make, why ICWA then? Why did Congress add a tribal interest? And that is the mix that both Greg and Bruce have mentioned, that state judges have some problem. Wait a minute, I'm just used to usually the parent and then an adopted parent. And what's the best interest? But here we have the tribal interest. And what I've been saying more and more lately, why do nations around the world worry about a declining birth rate? Why is there so much in the news about Japan now as their population ages? Why did China reverse its one-child policy when it saw a downturn in population? Why is the U.S. relatively worried about this? And that's kind of tied into the immigration policies, et cetera. But the tribal nations were literally going out of existence, not out of some natural thing because Indian peoples are evolutionarily weaker than other races, but because of what George Washington said, we're hunting you and we're taking your children. We're going to assimilate your children through the boarding schools, through everything there is. What was the theme of the boarding school? Kill the Indian in them and save the man. So the whole purpose was to destroy tribal cultures and Indian existence and tribal existence. And Congress saw that, realized its obligation to Native peoples and Native nations through the Constitution itself, and passes ICWA to protect against these nations just disappearing by their children being stolen and assimilated.
Yes, and Bruce, you have a response as well.
I so appreciate what both Greg and Bob just said there, and it reminded me that the importance of telling our national stories and how difficult that has become in the modern era with state after state. You know, I happen to teach in a state. New Hampshire is one of those states that has a law that forbids the teaching of divisive concepts in K through 12. And there's a bill that was introduced last year. I don't think it passed to extend that into the public universities. And that just means the discourse in terms of understanding our national stories, how did things get to this point, is becoming much more complex. And teachers, those particularly in public universities, increasingly have to worry that they may cross a line that could cost them a license to teach. And I think that that's a horrible scenario, that we can't have open and fair and honest discourse about, you know, what were the problems that led to a law like ICWA. And that is just one of any number of laws that we can talk about in the context of tribes and their rights to distinctive treatment in this country. And for folks who have taken a racialized angle to anything, to say, well, that group over there that I don't belong to shouldn't have anything, any more rights than I have. We shouldn't have super Americans or super rights in this country. Things are sort of, you know, devolved to a very simplistic kind of standard to say we don't look back if the whole point is to make us feel bad about what happened in the past for which none of us are responsible. It's like, well, guess what? You're the beneficiaries of a system that was so skewed that has affected the way that our world functions today. And if we don't look back, we can forget about trying to find any equitable solutions to today's really serious problems.
And to add to that is so much of this is about providing historical context, that these cases don't come out of nowhere. They come out of a historical context and historical relations, which is less about indicting individuals and more about understanding why it was so important. Native children being sold to white families is a part of the history and that being a part of the context. But Greg, before we conclude, I wanted to ask you and, you know, put this on the table. This case reinforces ICWA. The court had the opportunity to overturn it, chose not to. Is the way we should read this is that there's numerous areas of Indian law that certainly are still under a threat, but ICWA's pretty safe. Or, I mean, does the case leave open the possibility they could revisit this?
So it certainly leaves open the possibility of future challenges. In fact, Brett Kavanaugh in his concurrence sort of specifically invites the plaintiffs to try again on the equal protection issue and signals he thinks it is a, quote, serious concern. That said, I'm cautiously optimistic that we won't see these challenges come back at least for a little while. I think it's striking that Kavanaugh is by himself. He doesn't get any of the other justices to sign on to his concurrence. And, you know, I think the other side can count just as well as we can. And, the fact that neither Barrett nor Roberts seemed any inclination to go down that route means that it's going to be potentially tricky for them to get to five. And I think this court feels, I would bet, doesn't have an appetite for engaging further with this. So, that doesn't, however, mean ICWA is safe. I mean, one of the striking things about ICWA, too, that I think is really important to emphasize is that the law was upheld against this sort of full frontal attack. And that's really important. But ICWA is one of these statutes where it needs to actually be enforced in order to be meaningful. And one of the striking things is that state courts have often not fully complied with the law. Sometimes they lack the resources to do so. It's in these everyday child welfare proceedings that the law is actually given teeth and made meaningful. And so, you know, there's really important work that advocates have been doing on the ground to ensure that state courts are complying with ICWA before this decision, and they're going to have to keep doing with that work afterward. In other words, the statute, although it's wonderful that it survived, it's a really important victory. The statute, people have to, you know, make those rights real and meaningful in order for them to be effective.
And of course, always as a reminder, as a congressional act, congressional acts can be repealed. So also, you know, who's sitting in Congress absolutely matters as well. Bob, you had some thoughts on this.
Yes, my mother told me I shouldn't have gone to law school because I was already cynical enough before I went. So I am delighted that Greg is pretty hopeful and I hope he's right. But Kavanaugh's concurrence just sort of chilled me because I can imagine that Alito and Thomas agree with him. And then I'm afraid, did Roberts hide behind a standing argument in this case to avoid reaching this issue? What will he do if one of these cases comes back and the standing argument doesn't prevent the court deciding the race versus nationality or political issue? So is everything coming down to Amy Coney Barrett? I want to just give a couple statistics very quickly. Our heroes used to be Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Breyer. And according to a recent study, Ruth Bader Ginsburg voted pro-tribal 49% of the time and Breyer did 39% of the time. Compare that, if my numbers are fully up to date, that Justice Gorsuch, since he joined the court in April 2017, has voted the pro-tribal position in, I believe, 11 out of 13 cases. And Justice Barrett, if my numbers, I might be off at a case or two, I believe Justice Barrett has voted the pro-tribal position 4 out of 7 cases she's been on. So I find some hope there, Greg, and maybe I'll join your camp.
Yeah, and that had been noticed by a number of people that for all of the perceptions about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she didn't have the greatest record on Indian law questions. And Gorsuch certainly seems to have a different record. Greg, you want to respond?
Just very quickly, I'm not usually optimistic. I think part of this is Fertitta was such an extreme case. And I think we saw this morning, we talked a little about beforehand, the Navajo Nation water case, you know, that is decided 5-4 against the Navajo Nation. I think that we're going to see more of those sorts of cases. Castro Huerta is still in our memory. So if I were representing a Native nation, I would not be eager to take a case to this Supreme Court. I think Burkine was just such a sort of extreme challenge that even the court said, okay, this is enough. And, you know, I also think this is a court that has the power to grant or withhold cert. And I think they are not necessarily eager to revisit this question right away, I would bet. Yes, it's true. They punted it on standing in part because they didn't want to resolve it, I think. But they can continue to just basically punt by refusing to grant cert on future petitions. So, you know, the court has a lot of discretion about what kinds of cases it hears.
I think with that, we're going to end with a cautious optimism. Our guests today have been Gregory Obloski. He is the Marion Rice Kirkwood Professor of Law at Stanford Law and the author of The Savage Constitution and Federal Ground, Governing Property and Violence in First U.S. Territories. He also filed an amicus brief on behalf of the tribes in the case Holland v. Brackeen. Robert J. Miller is professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He is interim chief justice at the Passamaquoddy Tribe Court of Appeals. He's the author of Reservation Capitalism, Economic Development in Indian Country and Native America, and quite recently, A Promise Kept, The Muscogee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma. And he is an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. And N. Bruce Dutu. He is Samson Uckham Professor and former Chair of Native American and Indigenous Studies at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Shadow Nations, Tribal Sovereignty and the Limits of Legal Pluralism, and a contributing author of Felix S. Cohen's Handbook of Federal Indian Law. He's also produced a documentary called Dawland about the impact of the removal of children from Wabanaki families for placement in foster homes with white families, and is an enrolled tribal member of the United Houma Nation of Louisiana. Thank you all very, very much for joining us and sharing your expertise.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.